The Theosophical Society presents N. Sri Ram in a talk entitled The Nature of Consciousness, Part 1.
I propose to try to understand it on the basis of what we can observe and experience for ourselves. So if it is possible, we will not think of what somebody has said in some book about consciousness, associate it with various other things that might have been written about it, but just try each one to see, can't we understand it for ourselves? And in trying to understand, of course, we take up the attitude that I certainly take up the attitude that I do not have the answers to all the questions. I'm just trying to understand as far as we can go. Now, let us take the meaning of the word consciousness. It just implies being conscious. That is all. And nothing more. Conscious of what is around. Of those things which we can observe. No other activity, such as thinking, which comes later in evolution. We see that even insects are conscious. Plants are conscious in a vague way. Animals are also conscious. But it is only later in the evolutionary process that thinking starts, which is a different kind of activity, as I shall try to point out. Or, in our own personal experience, suppose you wake up some morning without any dream. Just at that moment, you are merely conscious of your surroundings. Perhaps after a second, you might start thinking about so many things. But just the moment you are awake, you are merely conscious. So unless we understand that state of being just conscious and nothing more, we will not understand the nature of consciousness in its essence. Because our understanding is confused by so many activities that take place, which activities to a large extent suppress and eclipse its essential nature. Now, here I am. I am aware of what is before me. I am aware of what is around. I am aware of the fact that I am speaking. I am aware of my emotions and feelings while I am addressing you. That is to say, if I have any. And in doing this, in just being conscious of all things around, there is no particular act of will that is involved. Now, is it possible for us to put our minds in that condition when we merely look at the things, observe without any thinking? No thinking. Not saying, oh yes, this is nice, that is bad, I saw it yesterday, the day before yesterday, and so on. No such thinking at all. Just see things as they are. Of course, all action arises from an impulse which we may call will, because there is nothing which moves without an impulse, and that impulse to action may be called will. So in that sense, there is will involved perhaps in seeing. I am saying, perhaps advisedly, we mustn't just presume there is will involved in seeing. The question is it involved? There is no particular will in the mere seeing. You just open your eyes, you see. You close your eyes, you are oblivious of what is before you. So if I have my eyes closed and I open them, then obviously there is the will to see. And they say that in all life there is the will to live. I am saying they say, perhaps there is the will to live. In all our thinking, we must be very careful not to make assumptions. That is really logical thinking. But that is extremely rare, because we are unconscious of our assumptions. So it is well to be conscious of what we assume. We may assume for good reasons. Every hypothesis or theory is an assumption. But the man of science knows very well, and equally a philosopher who is logical knows very well, that it is just a supposition. There is a certain fact here, and there is another fact there, or a whole set of facts. You can't actually observe the relationship between them. So you need some kind of a bridge to connect them. And that bridge is sometimes a mathematical equation or some kind of a supposition or theory. So in that way you see that this theory, supposition, equation, whatever it may be, it bridges facts which otherwise would be unrelated. That is perfectly legitimate. But then when we make an assumption unconsciously, well, we have just accepted the idea. It is born somehow, but we have not really examined it. When there is just a condition of seeing, of awareness, which is not some peculiar word. Being aware is just to be, to know what is round about. It being just in that condition covers a whole field of particulars. Now, I am looking at this tent. I am not thinking. But I am aware of all the particulars simultaneously. So there is this awareness which embraces all the things and persons before the perceiving consciousness, more or less. I can't say I am aware of everything. I have not reached that condition in which I can be aware of everything in this hall or roundabout. But more or less, I am aware of all the persons, the whole setup, all the things here, the trees and the grass round about. In fact, all that involves no effort on my part. They are all just reflected in the consciousness when it is passive without any thought, which is extremely difficult for many people. They cannot be without any thought. All the time the mind is acting. So it is throwing up images. It's wandering the whole time. And if there is any thinking, suppose I start a train of thought, the attention goes along that train. And that interferes with the contact between the perceiver, myself, and the objects which are perceived. So I cannot pay full attention when part of the energy of my attention goes off into various channels of thought. That is obvious. So you can pay full attention, you can be fully aware of what is before you, only when this confrontation of the consciousness, or rather the confrontation of the object by the consciousness, is not disturbed in any way. It should not be distracted. Somebody mustn't come on one side and say, look here, and so on, and you pay attention immediately. The contact between myself and the object before me is lost. Of course, I am saying these things which are perfectly obvious. But you know, it is good to, there are many things which are obvious which we do not perceive. And when you try to understand for yourself, you have to go over the ground of facts which you want to understand. And when you see these facts, they become immediately obvious. So, when we are aware in this manner, that is to say, just passively exposing the consciousness to the objects before it, then that is a certain state of consciousness which might be described as negative. You know, when people hear the word negative, they don't like it. The positive is good, the negative is bad. That is the conclusion which we have reached. It all depends upon the sense in which you use words. But you look at a photographic plate, is it not a negative? If it were not a negative, it would not be able to receive the impressions which it does. So the negative is an extremely sensitive surface which receives impressions and records them. I am using the word negative with regard to the consciousness in that sense. Not a vacant mind which is ready to be occupied by any intruder, any wandering ghost or spirit. I am not using the word negative in that sense. Nor am I using the word negative to mean indifference. It is not that. But it is a condition of receptivity instead of a condition of going forward to act, to make an impact upon somebody or on some situation. So in this kind of awareness, in which there is the possibility of reflecting in oneself the facts, the situation before one, there is no picking out, no selective action. You just receive the impressions as they come. That is not the case with thought. The moment you begin to think, you choose certain facts, you establish relations between them. So there is always, out of various things which have been registered in the memory, a picking out of certain things and establishing relations between them. So thought is highly selective. In fact, it is very partial in its operation, as I shall try to show later on, perhaps today or day after tomorrow. So in being merely conscious, there is no selective action, there is no picking out. And the consciousness can be extremely alert and not dart forth here and there. Do we realize that possibility? It can be fully awake. It can be receptive to the utmost extent. And yet, not going out here and there, not setting up various activities, various trains of thought. And that is really the confrontation of the object or objects without doing anything else. And it is only in that way that you come into direct and full contact with the object to be understood, the object which is to be perceived. If you want really to understand a person, if you start passing judgments upon him, oh, he is this person, I see, he looks a little peculiar and so on. Suppose you start passing judgments upon him, how can you understand that person? You are engaged in pronouncing judgment, not in understanding. So one has to refrain from all that and just be with the person, just listen to him, just look at him as quietly as possible, without any kind of thinking about him. If it is necessary to think about his actions or whatever it is pertaining to him, perhaps one can do it afterwards. So when we meet a person, we have to be receptive to the person to understand him. We have to be open to him. That is part of an open mind. An open mind doesn't mean that we question what we already know to be true. You know, we have seen certain truths, we accept them as true, but we must have an open mind, therefore we must question those truths. That's an absurdity, is it not? The grass is green. I believe it is green. I am convinced it is green. But I have been told I must have an open mind. Therefore, I must begin to question whether the grass is really green. Well, that is a kind of an artificial manipulation or management of the mind, which can never give you the truth. The mind must function in a natural way. You must not force yourself to believe. You must not force yourself to disbelieve. You must not fall for something. We must not shy away from that thing. It is only in that condition that we can know the truth. That is the condition of realism. You use whatever word you like. Realism, objectivity, confrontation effect. Words do not matter, provided we understand what is that state of mind, attitude, what is the condition to which we are referring. But when the mind is conditioned, as the minds of all of us are. You know, what I mean by conditioning is this. When something has been done to the consciousness so that it is not in its own state, it has been altered somewhat. This consciousness is also a field of consciousness. In the Bhagavad Gita, I am not quoting it as an authority, but just an interesting side light, if you regard it as light. There is a chapter entitled The Knower and the Field. The Field and the Knower of the Field. The consciousness in its own nature is a continuum. If anything is a continuum, it is that. That is a continuum. But when something has been done to it, when it has become crumpled, twisted, distorted, stained, colored, processed, you know, made up, when something has been done to that, then it acts in an entirely different way. Then there is perhaps this selectivity. Oh yes, I like that. Therefore I pay attention to that. So it begins to go towards particular things, move towards particular things, particular people, and move away from others. You know, there are always forces in the subconscious mind, that is to say, in that part of our mind of the contents of which or the activities of which we are not aware. That is what subconscious means. It's like the basement which you don't see, assuming you are in the living room. Well, there are forces in the subconscious which direct the mind in one direction rather than another. You go to a shop, it is full of things which are displayed, but you instinctively turn to certain objects and not to others. And that depends upon what you are interested in. If a person is interested in hats, then surely the person turns to the hats immediately, or to some particular kind of hat. If you are interested in something else, you look at that. Or even when you meet a person, your attention is turned towards that particular with regard to the person which draws your interest, and you don't notice other things. And this is a thing that with which we are all familiar. This is just to show that when the mind has already developed certain likes and dislikes, certain partialities, certain interests which predominate, then the mind, the attention, will naturally turn towards that which it finds interesting. And it will accordingly, it will be turned away from those things which do not come within the circle of its interest. So in its own native state, native condition, the consciousness is just like a mirror. If you place a mirror here, then you will see reflected in the mirror all the things, all the persons exactly as they are. If it is a true mirror, of course. It reflects what is before it without an effort. That is what I really meant when I said there is no special act of will involved in mere perception. Just as the eye reflects, you know, the eye reflects all the objects. Just as a sheet of water reflects the landscape around it, provided it is calm, it is smooth and level. There is a remarkable similarity between seeing and the action of consciousness in its negative state. Perhaps this is deeply significant. Seeing is an operation of the eye, which is the organ of vision. But the paying of attention is not merely an effort of the eye or of the ear. There is the mind, the consciousness involved. But there is a similarity between seeing and the action of the consciousness when it is in its negative state. I have already explained what I mean by negative, so that I needn't go over it. It's this sensitive state that is negative. One's physical vision can, of course, be distorted. One can see things double, or colors wrong if he is color blind. So similarly, when the consciousness, its nature, its texture, the substance of it gets altered, then it also suffers distortion. That is to say, it sees things wrongly, out of perspective. It sees certain things which are convenient to itself, it won't see other things. You know, that is always the case. We always want to believe what we like to believe, and if there are certain facts which conflict with that belief, we prefer to ignore it. We don't like to see it. That is the condition of most people. They want to be comfortable. They want to see what is pleasant to see. They don't want to see other things. If there are other things which are nasty, which are disturbing, let them be out of sight. And if somebody has to see to that, let it be somebody else, not me. You see, that is the attitude of every one of us. We like to go away from something which is unpleasant. That is the escapism. It's almost in the blood of people. I don't exempt myself in all these observations, you may be quite sure. If I, otherwise, perhaps I would not have known anything about it. But when there is no distortion, what it perceives is the truth. It is just the truth. You don't have to seek truth. There is a phrase in the Bible, seek peace and ensue it. We needn't seek the truth. The truth is obvious. It is just there before you. And whatever is perceived in that state of consciousness is true, because it exists, that is all. When I say is truth, it means it exists. It is not a hallucination. It's not a mental illusion, similar to an optical illusion. You know, we all know that there can be an optical illusion. You can be made to see a ghost where there is none. With an arrangement of lenses and light and so on, a certain figure may be made to hang in the air, and you may think it is there, but it is not there. It can be done. So it is not that, but what it sees is true. In other words, it is seeing without fancying, or without injecting anything extraneous into the object of perception, or even into the process of perception. Suppose you have a pet idea, and that surely somehow, before you know, it has come in, it has already come into the process of your perception. Or suppose there is a subconscious wish, or even an inclination, that will surely color your mental scene. That is why we have to be very, very chary of accepting visions which people see. They say they have seen a vision. A person is a clairvoyant. Perhaps he is, he may be. But he sees something, and honestly he says, I see it, and he describes it to you. But then, it is, if he has any kind of a subconscious wish, he may not even be aware of it. Or not even a wish, just an inclination to see things that way. Then that will certainly come into the process of his seeing. It will be colored, it will be distorted. What he sees will be shaped by this subconscious inclination. So we have to remember that fact. It is seeing, when you see negatively, without anything of that sort, then it is only then that there is no distortion. But if you see with an effort, suppose a person makes an effort. Let it be a clairvoyant, since I have referred to a clairvoyant. He makes an effort to see. And while he makes an effort to see, perhaps he will see wrongly. Because the effort itself will distort the perception. You know, when you make an effort, it means you tense the muscles. The muscles of the structure, you tense your nerves so that the whole structure is a little bit altered. And if the structure is the structure of a lens, some organ of vision, surely it will be affected by the effort which is made. It is only what you perceive without an effort which is likely to be true. Every kind of effort has behind it some direction, some motive. It may be subconscious, but nevertheless it affects the process of seeing. Now the ancient rishis of India, I do not know whether you have come across this term, were called sages. In ancient India, there were many of these rishis, plenty of them. That sounds a little disrespectful, does it not? I didn't mean that. But the literal meaning of the word rishi is seer. That is the meaning of the word. It did not refer to clairvoyance in the ordinary sense. Of course, some of them might have been clairvoyant, and probably were. It didn't mean a person who just had various visions. It meant seeing the truth of things, the essence of things. In fact, the word which is used in Sanskrit is seeing the essential nature of a thing. Which, if I literally translate it, the English word would be that-ness. A thing has its own quality, its own nature, which makes it different from any other thing. So the essence of the thing is called that-ness, the quality which belongs to it. In English, it sounds a little peculiar. Now, where life is, there is consciousness, because every living thing is conscious in some degree or other. It is in fact an attribute of what we call spirit when we regard the whole of the universe as arising from spirit matter, a relationship between these two principles. Consciousness is an attribute of being. It's an attribute of life. So, we perceive the nature of the spirit only in a consciousness which is entirely free of conditioning. Because if the consciousness is conditioned in any manner, your image of the spirit will be according to the conditioning. We all use the word God. I am sure that the image in each one's mind evoked by this term God is different from the image in somebody else's mind. And every image that is formed in the consciousness is formed out of material existing in the consciousness. And this material is really an accumulation of experiences. And of course the image also depends very much upon the inclinations of the person. Various psychological forces which are in operation to create that image. So the God of one person is not the same as the God of another, although we all use the same word. So, if there is any kind of a conditioning, then our notion of a spirit will be according to that conditioning. So it is only a consciousness which is absolutely unconditioned which can know the nature of the spirit or what is spiritual in truth. Of course, there are so many things which are spiritual, so-called. It is only so-called. It is not spiritual in the real sense. If you postulate a spirit or Atman, the term which was used this morning, you have to regard life as existing in it and as arising from its relationship or polarity with matter. So if there is life in the universe, then of course there must have been life present in the very origin of things, in the very source, in that fundamental basis from which everything has arisen. So when we talk of the spirit, it is really the living spirit. It is not something dead. It is not an object. It is really life in a condition which we cannot realize. The essence of life, we might say, the very essence of life. Or, if you like, life and consciousness in their unconditioned state. Therefore, because they are unconditioned, therefore it is a condition of absoluteness, which is a difficult word to understand. Now, if we take life as it is, in a plant, in an animal, in ourselves, we see that wherever there is life, there is what you might call the lust for life. Life, there is always in life a certain urge which we may call desire. It seeks experience. It seeks to appropriate things. Life is moved by forces of desire. That is to say, life as we ordinarily see it. I believe HPB says somewhere that both life and consciousness are septenary. 7 grades, 7 degrees, 7 qualities or kinds. And there is life in the lower forms, at any rate, including ourselves, this thirst for sensation or experience. And there is a constant seeking of fulfillment, which implies the existence of a void. When a person seeks fulfillment, it means that there is a certain void which he is seeking to fill. That is why we seek experience. We say, well, that will be an experience. But why do we want experience? We seek experience because we are not satisfied to be as we are. There is a certain emptiness in ourselves, a void which we are seeking to fill. And we think that this void will be filled by the sensation which we seek or the experience which we are going to have. But the void is never filled. It's perhaps filled for the time being. But when we use the word spirit and say it is life in its unconditioned state, it is life not seeking fulfillment, but in a state of fulfillment. I hope it is clear what I am saying. But it is in a condition in which it is not limited by that fulfillment as we are limited. You may wonder why we say limited by fulfillment. You know, when a person is satisfied, he becomes quiescent. He tends to become dormant. Satisfaction always creates a state of stagnation, a mental stagnation. I don't mean to say we should not be satisfied. We should always be dissatisfied. I don't say that. When you eat food, you are satisfied, of course. But you can be satisfied, but still you need not, as it were, be entrenched in that state of satisfaction. Of course, all this is somewhat subtle, as you can see. Now, when we talk of awareness, we have to realize that this awareness can be in any degree. It can be limited, it can be extensive. I can be aware of a few things, I can be aware of many things. This awareness can be superficial, it can be deep. It can be partial, it can be total. There are all these possibilities. I am saying it because it all refers to the nature of consciousness, is it not? It can be conscious totally, it can be conscious partially. It can see only the surface, the exterior, the appearance, but it can see deeply. Its awareness can be limited to certain things, but its awareness can also be unlimited. It is such an extraordinary thing, what we call consciousness, although we just take it for granted. We do not see of what nature it is, how extraordinary it is. There can be awareness not only of the concrete things and the differences between them. This is yellow, that is green, this is tall, that is short, and so on. There can be an awareness also of the relations between things. The relations between things can be perceived instantaneously in a glance. That is to say, suppose I am aware of so many objects. I am aware of something short, something long. The moment I see both of them, I am just aware of them. I am not thinking about them. Am I not aware immediately of the difference between the two? I am aware of the difference between the two. They may be near each other or they may be far away from each other. That is a certain relationship. I am aware immediately of that relationship. It doesn't require thinking to take in the relationships between things which you perceive altogether instantaneously as a totality. Because the relationships are implicit. When you see the things, you see the relations between them. That is, we can do that. You can say, well, I don't do that. I don't perceive the relations between things. No, we don't. I don't either. But we can see it is possible to do it. And there can be awareness of more subtle things. There can be awareness of beauty, of harmony, of proportion, of the feelings which are expressed by some person, not in so many words. They are on the face of the person. Or perhaps you just approach the person and you know what is the person's mood, what feelings he has. There can be awareness of all this. There can be awareness of every subtle movement of thought and feeling in ourselves. There can be awareness of the expression in a thing or in a person. All this is possible. All this is awareness. It is not a matter of trying to find out. There is no trying to find out, as I have already said. Awareness precludes this trying. You just open your eyes and see, you perceive, or you don't perceive, as the case may be. But if you perceive, if you are aware, if your attention is given, then of course you see all this, or there is the possibility of seeing. I don't say everyone sees, every one of us sees all these things which I mentioned. We don't notice many things, they pass unnoticed, because we are not wholly aware. The consciousness is not on the spot, so to say. It is not active to the fullness of its capacity. It's just a little bit somnolent. Or it is going in one direction rather than in another. There can be this awareness. In other words, there is no limit to that awareness. Or yes, that is perhaps the best word, which is photographic, which is negative, which is receptive. You can take in so many things. And of course, we don't take in so many things. We perceive only a few things and let all the others go. We are not really in contact with this world except partially, or with anybody as for that matter. We don't perceive the things that are taking place before us. Do we perceive how graceful is the movement of a bird when it flies from a branch and settles down on the ground? Do we notice that? Sometimes we do, but very often we don't. And there are so many other things which we do not notice at all. And it requires some artist to notice it and paint a picture and say, look at that bird, it is so beautiful. But nature, I think, is infinitely more beautiful than what any artist has painted. I don't decry artists. I mean, it's all right, let them paint. And they have painted beautiful things. But there is such extraordinary beauty in nature, in life. If somebody paints a sunset on the canvas, we say, oh, beautiful sunset. But when the sunset is actually there on the skies, we pass it by. Perhaps we admire the cleverness of the artist, his technique. In that case, we are not admiring the sunset. We are admiring the technique of the artist or his cleverness, which there is a little difference between admiring the sunset and admiring the cleverness of the man who has made a picture that so vividly recalls the actual sunset. I'm merely pointing out that we are not wholly in touch with this world. And that is the state of consciousness in its purity, in its essence. That is what it is. It is not something to be cultivated. That capacity is inherently there. In fact, the negativity of the consciousness is a condition for reception. Unless it is negative, it doesn't receive everything that is before it. You know, the moment you begin to think, it suppresses this awareness. Suppose you listen to music. I hear the first two or three notes, and that recalls something to me. I begin to think about it. Oh, is it Debussy, or is it in that movement, or something like that, or whatever else it may be. I heard it in the living room of such and such a person the other day when I was having ice cream or something like that. You know how the thought associates with so many things which are really not relevant to the matter under consideration. So the moment there is this thought process set going, a train of thought started, you don't listen to the rest of the music, you listen only partially. And even if you take in the notes, you don't take in the music. There is a great difference between taking in the notes and taking in the beauty of the music. There are many people who can take in the notes. Perhaps they have been to a music school. They can tell you all about it. But then that doesn't mean that they have the fullest possible appreciation, let me put it that way, of the music itself, of the beauty, what it can do to you. If it is really beautiful music, unless you give your whole heart to it, you are only listening partially. Your heart must move with the notes. It must move along with them. Every note must fall upon your consciousness. And you must feel its beauty. You must feel the movement from the previous note to that note. Of course, even people who are trained to listen to music, they don't listen like that. I don't listen like that, I'm quite really confess. But I know there is that possibility. Perhaps I do sometimes. Anyhow, there is that possibility. It is only when you are absolutely negative, not thinking about anything, that you fully receive whatever is to be received. As I was saying a little while ago, if one can see things without thinking about them, we will be able to see many things that we otherwise miss. It's the silence of the mind which is necessary. Which doesn't mean that we can make any amount of noise but keep the mind silent, which won't be possible. Of course, silence is good. But it is not merely verbal silence. The silence of the mind is necessary for receptivity. It is only that condition which is the true condition. The real nature of consciousness in its own state. But our minds are constantly chattering. So many things. It's very difficult to keep the mind quiet. And if one has succeeded in silencing this mind, then he has come a long way towards an understanding of all things pertaining to himself. In that condition, let me use another word instead of silence, of tranquility. When the whole consciousness is like a lake which is not agitated by any breeze, which is clear of any mud, of any impurities that are carried in the waters, then, of course, you just perceive, you see right down to the bottom. So, consciousness is sensitiveness itself. That is what consciousness is, sensitiveness itself. But we don't think so because we know it only under heavy limitations. It's heavily limited, limited by the capacity of the brain and limited also otherwise. Limited by its own activities. What it develops within its own body, as it were, by its responses. So we do not know the nature of consciousness in its purity, although we are using it all the time. We are conscious. We are using it all the time, but we do not know it. So we do not know what it can record. How sensitive it can be, we do not know that. If somebody writes about it, you have to take that statement or you reject it, as the case may be. It depends upon whether you believe in that writer or you don't believe in him. So we have to take these things second hand. But these are things that can be known by ourselves directly at first hand. And it is good to know it that way. It's good to read the Secret Doctrine and all the other books and so on. It is all good. They are good in their own way. They have their place. They have their value. They suggest things. There is a clue. There is a signpost. A statement is made. But you have to experience the truth of it for yourself. Somebody says, this is wonderfully beautiful. If I say, oh yes, he knows very well, he's a great artist. It is wonderfully beautiful. Suppose I say that, I just echo his statement. I don't know it's wonderfully beautiful, I have not felt any beauty. I merely repeat his statement, because he's supposed to be an authority on art or beauty or whatever it may be. That is very much what we do with regard to many things. We have to try to understand for ourselves, even though it may be just a little extent, it doesn't matter. Let us begin in a small way. Try to use our own intelligence. Try to observe, try to understand. And even when you study, don't just swallow the statements. The statement may be profoundly true. But neither the truth nor the profundity will be manifest to you when you swallow it. The mistake is in swallowing. Or it may not be so profound, who knows. Or it may be mostly true, perhaps not wholly true. It may need some qualifications. So in all these matters, I think that we should feel free, sufficiently bold, to consider it for ourselves, realizing that our understanding is very limited, realizing that we are apt to make many assumptions, realizing that with all our theosophy, we do not have the answers to all questions. I don't believe in that. Well, it is said of, you know, akasha, to use a Sanskrit term, which has been translated as ether. HVB sometimes translates it as ether, sometimes she distinguishes it from ether. I may mention it incidentally. It is said of akasha that it records everything that takes place. It is so extraordinarily sensitive that it records not merely persons, things and all the happenings as some extraordinary film might record them, but it goes further than any film. It records even the thoughts and feelings of all the people who have been on the stage of this earth. It seems such an extraordinary thing. But can it not be so? If there can be some substance which is so wonderfully sensitive that it can record the smallest objects, smallest things before it, the smallest shades, the smallest differences in the objects before it, can there not be some medium in nature which can also record all that. According to the ancient philosophers, there is such an all-pervading substance which is extraordinary. And everything has been recorded there because of the sensitiveness. And not only recorded, that medium is so extraordinary that everything recorded is retained. It is just there. No chemicals are needed to fix it. All the chemicals are in the very texture of that substance. I don't know whether there is a texture there, but one has to use some language to convey the idea. No one can say such an expanse, such an all-pervading expanse, medium, substance, cannot exist in this miraculous universe. You cannot say that. You can say, I don't know about it. That is perfectly legitimate. This is only a postulate, a hypothesis, theory if you like, or a concept. But the more this universe has been explored, the more miraculous it has proved to be. There is no question about it. Even during the last few years, so many things have been found with regard to the earth on which we live and the atmosphere around it. So many things have been found. It is becoming, many, many years ago, the Astronomer Royal of England wrote a book on this universe in which he, the title of it was The Mysterious Universe. But it is much more mysterious now than it was then. Well, to quote those well-known words, there are more things in heaven and earth than our philosophy dreams of. Now, it may be that in that fundamental or original state of matter, matter and consciousness are really one and the same. Or they may be one with each other. You know, in theosophical books we talk of root matter, that is matter in its original state, which was undifferentiated. And it is out of that state that all subsequent states have been formed or have evolved. That medium is also in ourselves, because man is a being who comprises all the different levels of existence. Well, that again is a statement which has to be pondered over. It cannot be proved, because we don't know all the levels. We only know some of them. But it may be asked, how is it that we do not remember all things, just as this extraordinary medium, this ether, this akasha, just as it remembers? Why don't we remember? Well, we do not remember because our consciousness is not in its pure state. The mind which we use is not in that condition. Perhaps everything is recorded in some medium, even in ourselves, in some kind of a rock bottom layer. Perhaps all the impressions are there. But the mind which we use, it remembers only certain things and does not remember others, because it has been processed. Various things have happened to it. It has become insensitive. It has become thickened, if I might say so. Just as one skin, which may be delicate and sensitive, can become thick and lose its sensitiveness. So in the same way, it is possible for the consciousness also to acquire adipose tissue, let me say, So in that way to lose its sensitiveness. Now in ordinary biology, they regard consciousness as not merely based upon, as not merely using an organization, but as a product of the organization. I don't say all science, there are many scientists who take a different view. But many of them still do not give life or consciousness in a particular form a status apart from that form. They regard it as a product of the form, as a kind of epiphenomenon of activities taking place in that form, in that organization. But perhaps when we go into the matter deeply, it may be that they merely use the organization as a vessel or a means for the implementation of its impulses, of its purpose, if you want to use the word purpose. So, if this view is valid, then one can think of a continuing individuality, the individuality being a thing of life and consciousness. So the individuality may be regarded as having a status of its own, independent of the form or organization which it uses. I think I had better proceed tomorrow because it's already time, but I would like just to say this, that what we call the evolution of life is really evolution of consciousness in all its aspects, plus the evolution of the organization or form that is needed for the expression of its potentiality, its character. When we say organization, an organization is intended for performance. With the organization, the indwelling life acts in a certain manner. But when we use the word form, it has a certain significance or meaning which is perceived by the artist. So there is some sense in using the word form, and not only organization. It is said that the eyes are the windows of the soul, you know, a well-known proverb. You can see something of the nature of a person, his mood and his feelings, in his face, the tone of his voice, in his whole demeanor and bearing. This shows that life and the thoughts of the person, the way he thinks, molds his expression. It does mold the form. Even though we must not draw conclusions too readily from what we observe about a person, we must be very careful not to do that. So the thoughts mold the expression, and therefore the form or the expression suggests the nature of the indwelling life and the consciousness. There is in nature not only evolution as we know it, the evolution of organizations, but also an evolution of order, an evolution of harmony, of beauty, of significance. I think that when we look deeply into the nature of the evolutionary process, we will perceive that everything is proceeding towards a more integrated order, which will be much more significant than the present order which exists in nature. And an order in which each thing, because of the process that it has gone through and because of its relationship with other things, has its maximum significance. This is a view of evolution which is deeply inspiring, not merely the evolution of forms and organization, evolution of individuality, evolution of harmony, evolution of significance, evolution of order. When you say significance, that covers all that. Because what is significant? Beauty is significant, order is significant, harmony is significant, intelligence is significant, sensibility is significant, all these things are significant, and the evolutionary process you can see by mere observation that we are moving onward towards that condition in which there will be the maximum of significance in the whole order of nature and in each individual thing that is comprised in that order.